Charles Franklin is Wisconsin's best-known pollster. He is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and a law school faculty member. He co-founded pollster.com in 2005. He's a past president of the Society for Political Methodology, and he's a member of the ABC News Election and Analysis Team, and he's been a member since 2002. But polling and its role, especially in choosing the 10 Republican candidates who debated last night in Cleveland, has never been more controversial. So it's a great time for our newsmakers with Charles Franklin. Welcome back to
Wisconsin.
Good to be
here. Thank you.
Let's start with that, the criteria of who got to play at the big table last night in Cleveland. Polls' number one criteria for the 10 chosen and the 7 who, let's be polite, weren't chosen?
Yeah, it was controversial from the moment Fox announced that they were going to do that. It puts an awful burden on polling for candidates who are, let's face it, getting 2%, 3%, and 4% of the vote.
Right.
And it's arbitrary. Do you cut it off at 8, at 9, at 10, at 11? Where does that fall? That said, you have to have some sympathy that a debate with 17 people would have been difficult. And actually, right now, the Federal Election Commission has over 500 candidates registered for president. So some selection has to be done at some stage. How do you do it? I think the argument for using the polls rather than allowing network executives to simply make the decision on their own preferences would be at least as controversial. So there is some advantage to using the polls as an objective standard. Now, the fact was, there were a lot of scenarios in which the polls could have varied a lot mm-hmm. about who was in 10th place and in and who in 11th and out.
Right.
But as it actually happened, over the last 10 polls, it wouldn't have mattered which five you picked. The top 10 would have had the same average out of any of those five, any five of those 10 polls.
But within 12 hours of the debate, they announced, okay, Kasich is in and Perry's out. So some people were on the verge of getting bumped yeah. and got bumped by the criteria of where they were in the polls or other extenuating factors?
Well, Perry had actually been in 11th place in just about all of those polls. I don't mean in every poll, but I mean in the average of the most recent five, the next most recent five, and so on. Perry was on the bubble in all of those, but just shy of getting in by the average across those. Still, it's a close thing. It's a bad decision rule in one sense. Some of my polling colleagues and others proposed two debates with randomly assigning mm-hmm. 8-1 and 8-the other or mm-hmm. 8-9. I personally would have preferred that on the grounds that it didn't arbitrarily select who got the exposure.
Right.
There are some downsides to doing that as well. In the end, the network made a decision, but it's not the last decision. We've got more debates coming up, and all of those are going to have to make similar decisions of who to include.
When Fox said, we're going to pick the 10 largely based on how they poll, did professional pollsters like you say, whoa, what we do just got a lot more complicated, a lot more writing on it, and did professional pollsters like you have some major concerns about that criteria?
Some did. One pollster in particular,
Marist,
stopped polling on the primary because they said they didn't want to be part of that. And that, I thought, was a principled position for them to take. On the other hand, if we all just stopped polling on it, then the decision would be made on no information about public support, then what would you do? Would it be less controversial to make a decision without information? So I do think this is a case where there are various competing values. It's hard to be Solomon and know exactly what the right solution is. I just breathe a sigh of relief that the polling really was remarkably consistent over the last 10 polls or so. And therefore, you really weren't in the nightmare case where if the last poll was the one that decided who was in or out, that would have put tremendous pressure on that one.
Well, do I have this right? Mara said, we're not going to poll. because some candidates are trying to do all they can to get the headlines, maybe run special ads to try to crash into the top 10. That was Marist's reason?
Yeah. That was one of the things that they pointed out. I think they are also concerned about the arbitrariness of omitting some candidates, including others. But but from a polling perspective, it's at least theoretically possible that the things the candidates did in those last 2 weeks might have bumped their numbers a bit. Now, I'm more of a skeptic on that. I find that it's actually pretty hard to bump the numbers intentionally. Or put a different way, aren't they always out there trying to bump their numbers all the time anyway?
That's
so,
true.
You know, but you can imagine an ad campaign coming out or a particularly controversial or attention-getting statement. So you can game the system a little bit. But in my experience, it's harder to move public opinion appreciably in a very short period of time just because you want it to be so. You can move it fast by making a huge mistake. You can move it fast when a big event intervenes.
Yep.
But sort of routinely trying to bump your numbers from, say, what would have practically mattered, bump your numbers from 2% to 5%.
Yes.
Doesn't sound like very much, but the bottom seven, or at least the bottom six, have been at 2% or less since January. This is not really a group that's been bumping up to six in some polls and back down to one.
Well,
in
as
others.
Somebody who studies your MU polls, and at times, thank you for sharing the crosstabs. Here's my question. How fair is it to include in the top 10 somebody who's polling at 2.8% and exclude somebody who's polling at 1.8%, given the margin of errors that you guys include?
Absolutely, and that's... That margin of error in the individual polls failed to separate Perry from Kasich, I think, or Kasich. In that last set of polls.
Kasich was in, Perry, you're
Perry
out.
Perry was out. But again, I come back to the fact that the averages of the polls were consistently separating the two. Now, should it be the 10th versus the 11th?
Mm-hmm.
The 9th versus the 10th, where should that cut be? That's an arbitrary decision that has nothing to do with the polling. If you're going to have a cutoff, somebody decides where that cutoff's going to be, and it's going to look pretty arbitrary. And with these candidates, a small gap between them, whether we're looking at the gap between 8th and 9th, 9th and 10th, 10th and 11th.
Right. Well, but how does... Well, you're on the ABC election team. How do you determine which of the polling houses, how many national pollsters are there now, Charles?
Well,
dozens, hundreds?
It's very hard to count. But if we count the major media polls and the major academic polls that do national polling, we're probably down to 10 or so.
10.
Now, there are a lot of other pollsters, like the Marquette poll, that specialize in a single state.
Yes.
But for the purposes of this national decision, it was a more limited set of national pollsters.
Is it a pretty easy call for Fox News to say, okay, we're going to pay attention to pollster A, B, C, D and not F, G, H in terms of who gets the slots at the 10 podiums?
That was somewhat easy, though not trivially easy. And they were not completely open in saying exactly what their criteria that were. They said these had to be national polls by recognized pollsters using industry standard methodologies. Well, those are vague to define.
Yes.
But for those of us in the business, that seemed to signal you were going to look at live interviews, in other words, a live interviewer, so you were going to not include automated polls of the kind that PPP does and Rasmussen does with a robocall voice, press one for Democrat, two for Republican. Secondly, it seemed to imply that you would include only pollsters that sampled cell phones as well, so no landline-only polls. And again, of the top pollsters, net media pollsters and university pollsters, they all use live interviewers, they all use cell phones. It would also eliminate any internet-based polls, which is a developing area in the field but is not yet universally accepted as a reliable methodology. So I thought with those considerations, they really did limit the field quite a bit. However, ABC News, for example, and the Washington Post had done a poll early in the month, or maybe it was late last month, which then fell out of the last five by the time we got to the decision point. Mm-hmm. So there's a good example of a poll that might well have been included in the final average, but simply because of when it was done, fell outside of the last five polls. The other decision they made was to exclude a newer NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, which seemed odd at the time. It's a well-respected pollster. But it turned out that the way that poll asked the vote question, it only named the top 9 or 10 candidates, and having listed them all in a previous question, said, would you vote for these top 9 or 10, and named them all,
right,
and then said, or one of the others that we just talked about, okay, instead of naming them. So that was an odd question, very unusual for a poll to ask a vote question that way. So I think Fox made the right call in not including a question or a poll that didn't include all 17 names when it asked the vote question.
As somebody who's covered the Capitol for a few years, it seems to me that more and more special interest groups are commissioning polls to prove what they want proven, and then they issue a press release. Is this a growing trend, and should voters be aware? How does a voter discern, okay, ABC Group hired this polling firm to come up with the conclusion that they want so they can get a PR bump by announcing it?
Right. It's got a long tradition of being done. I think it is being used as a lobbying tool or as a public relations tool quite a bit now. Mm-hmm. It is somewhat hard for the average reader to know the details here. Journalists have one obligation to write a story that explains.
Right.
So the first is, who's the sponsor of the poll, and do they have a direct interest in this issue? Who did they use for the pollster? Was it a reputable firm? That's much harder for the average reader to know, but not out of the reach of most journalists, I think. The biggest issue with interest group, or sometimes campaigns simply don't release that much of their polling anymore, so this is more of an interest group issue.
Unless it's good news.
If
it favors their candidate, they'll say, you know, they'll
then it
trumpet
just
it
might,
from the skies.
Then it just might come out.
Yeah.
But an interest group, the question is, how did they word the question? And sometimes you'll see a press release that gives the results favoring a position, but it only paraphrases what the question was about. It doesn't quote the question verbatim. I think an average reader can tell when a question has been strongly slanted to a position, mm-hmm, if they're simply allowed to read the question. And some groups are better about putting that out than others. Some respond when questioned by journalists by providing it. But what almost none do is release the entire questionnaire from top to bottom and the results for every single question.
Right.
That's something that differentiates media polling. It differentiates the Marquette poll,
yep,
where we always release every single question, every single answer, and a bunch of details about the methodology.
I just know in a previous life when I worked for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I was offered polls. You know, I had a checklist. Who sponsored it? Which firm did you use? What was the polling window? Mm-hmm. How long was it open? Was it live or was it robocalls? Can you release the actual questions? And what was the margin of error?
Right.
This was kind of a checklist. And if some group couldn't, I was less excited about a potential poll, yeah, that they wouldn't comply with my checklist.
Absolutely. And that checklist is something that almost all pollsters associations include your checklist as things that a firm should be ready to disclose.
Right.
The timing of the poll, how many were sampled, the margin of error, how was it done, live or robo, were cells included?
Or internet.
Sample size.
Yeah.
Geography, did it sample the entire state, for example, or just part of the state?
Right.
Those things are supposed to always be disclosed. My sense is those are usually the ones that people are willing to disclose because they don't tell you a whole lot except, is this awful? Where you would move the needle on a question is by phrasing it with a lot of positive arguments in the question and no negative arguments, or with very strong arguments on your side and a weak argument on the other, or even more, you actually asked 5 or 10 versions of the question and you report the result that gives you the best look.
How do professional pollsters respond when they're asked to do a deliberate push poll?
Yeah.
Designed to get to elicit a specific response?
Let me answer that in two parts. A push poll is a very special thing that pollsters get our hackles up. Asking about which message appeals the most, which arguments move people, is not what we consider a push poll.
Okay.
So I just want to make that distinction.
Thank you.
A push poll is usually two questions, one that says, hi, how's the weather today? The second of which says, did you know Joe Smith was a terrible person and does all these awful things?
Would you vote for Joe Smith if you knew that he had bankruptcy or was convicted of killing a dog?
And it's not a poll because they don't even record your answers. It's a telemarketing call that's done to hundreds of thousands of numbers. No poll samples more than 1,000 or 2,000 people typically.
Okay.
So I just want to make that distinction because push poll is a lightning rod and something that all pollsters organizations condemn as a practice and calling it a poll. So that's why I bring that up.
Now, go ahead.
But testing messages is a perfectly legitimate thing to do.
Yeah.
If you're working for a candidate or an interest group, you want to know, they want to know, which of their arguments carry the most weight with voters. What's the more persuasive argument? General good to the community or a particular change for certain areas in the community? Should I word the argument this way or should I word it that way? We don't consider those push polls at all.
Right.
They do present arguments and ask voters to respond.
Those are very valid questions about public policy, aren't they?
They are valid in the sense that they are legitimate questions, and everybody, both for and against an issue, frames their arguments in the ways they think will be more persuasive rather than less persuasive.
Okay.
So I see nothing wrong with doing that kind of testing. It is exactly to try to find out what will persuade people more or less. However, to then present only your most persuasive result and ignore everything else really is a form of public relations. It has nothing to do with representing the state of public opinion on the issue. In an ideal world, we'd ask 4 or 5 questions about each issue from different perspectives. And we present all of those results. In practice, unfortunately, we rarely have the time in a survey to ask more than 1 or 2 questions.
I'm really curious about changes in polling over the last, well, you've been doing this a while. Let's start with cell phones versus landlines. How has professional pollsters adjusted to pick up cell phones, and how do you get my cell phone number?
So how to get the number is the easy part. For both the landline and the cell phones, you can simply get a list of all the area codes and exchanges in the state or whatever geography you're sampling that go to landlines, and there's a separate block that goes to cell phones. Now, this is a little complicated because of number portability. You can keep your number when you move from one to the other. But for the most part, it still works quite well. When we sample, we then sample from that list and randomly make up the last 4 digits. That gives every possible number, whether landline or cell phone, an equal chance of being selected into the sample.
Okay.
And that's actually the magic of telephone sampling. It gives every possible number in the state the same chance of being selected, so it's not biased towards one group or another or one region or another.
So if you go through it, that's intriguing, Charles. Those numbers are chosen at random. Mm-hmm. And does that allow you to then know that as we shift more to cell phones and away from landlines, that's not a factor that you have to worry about because you're chasing numbers?
That's exactly right. There are practical issues with cell phones, but they don't interfere with that method of drawing a sample. That stuff still works really well. Really, the thing with cell phones was back when we had about 10% or 15% of households that were cell only. Mm-hmm. And remember those days we were paying by the minute and
yes.
our per minute charges were high?
Yeah, I'm hanging up now because this is costing me money.
Exactly. It was a very expensive proposition to ask someone to do an interview with you on your cell phone.
Yes.
But right now, cell phone penetration is about 50% of the country have a cell phone only. And about 90% of the country have a cell phone. They may also have a landline, but they have a cell phone. That's about where landlines were in the early 1950s, by the way. And very few people are very sensitive about their minutes anymore because they just pay a lump sum.
Yeah, for universal.
So ironically, calling cell phones has actually become easier as more and more of the public simply take calls on whichever phone rings. So it's not unlike in the old days of landlines, some households had two numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, either one, if they picked it up, you could talk to them.
So the issue of whether a professional pollster is balancing cell versus landlines has been removed.
It has largely been removed.
Okay.
The practical issues are because of FCC regulations, the cell phones have to be dialed manually rather than being dialed by a computer. So that makes them a little more expensive. Also, people are a bit less likely to pick up their cell phone than pick up their landline.
Right.
And, of course, the first question we ask of a cell phone user is it safe to talk right now? So there are some practical issues, but they're very small compared to what looked like a potential crisis 20 years ago when these were very expensive and people were very reluctant to
talk. Next question. How do pollsters deal with do not call lists?
Yep.
Wisconsin has one that's pretty popular.
That's right. Two things. One is national organizations keep a do not call list for people who get a telephone interview and say, put me on your don't call list. There is a list that blocks them from other calls. And our poll and practically every other poll screens numbers against those lists.
Okay.
However, public opinion polling is exempted from the do not call list.
Okay.
And therefore, the state's do not call list doesn't affect calls from pollsters or, for that matter, calls of a political nature.
Okay. How do you deal with, I don't want to lay an assumption. Are more people refusing to cooperate to take your poll questions?
Yes, is the easy answer.
Dramatically?
Dramatically less, for a variety of reasons. I was involved in a poll in 1988, telephone poll, national poll. We got a 75% response rate to that poll. In our latest Marquette poll, we had an 8% response rate.
8%?
8%.
A drop off of 80 percentage points?
Yeah, a huge drop, 70 percentage points, but a big drop.
Okay, thank you. My math is bad.
Well, I get paid to do math. Now, you'd say, oh my gosh, but that's what's happened to the entire industry. There are no national pollsters or state pollsters that have response rates much above the 8 to 15 range. 15 is even too high, 8 to 10 or so. But here's what's going on. That's because of call screening and answering machines that make it much harder to reach a human in the first place. To a lesser extent, it's refusals. So I just mentioned our 8%, and it varies from sample to sample. So we've been as low as about 6 and as high as about 9 or 10.
Wow.
But if someone picks up the phone in one of our interviews, we can typically get them to do an interview about 35 to 50% of the time.
Okay.
That's called the cooperation rate, because you've gotten through the barrier of reaching a human and speaking to them, and then do they cooperate? And the answer is they still cooperate at lower levels than they did 30 or 40 years ago. Why? Technologies make it harder to get somebody, and telemarketing calls has driven everybody a little bit crazy about picking up a phone when they don't know who's calling.
But professionals like you are still satisfied that even with the cooperation rate lowering, your results are still valid.
And that's the most critical part, because the intuition is obvious that if you have a response rate that low, then there's this is hopeless, right?
Yes.
But in fact, the accuracy of polls predicting election outcomes, even setting aside including the 2014, where it was about 2 points too pro-Democratic in 14, mm-hmm. Even setting those aside, the accuracy of predicting both state presidential outcomes and national presidential outcomes has actually very slightly improved over the last 30 years. So if the response rate was the only thing that mattered, we'd be in terrible shape. But what we actually see on the one benchmark, which is truly important, right? It doesn't matter what people say their approval or disapproval of the president is, if you get the vote wrong, you know you've got something terribly wrong. And we don't see any evidence that that's gotten worse over this time.
The journalist in me says, do not trust polls conducted over the internet, because can I vote 7 or 8, 9, 10 times? Is there any reason to trust a poll conducted over the internet?
Right. This is a really developing story. It's a research and development project, in my view, though advocates of it would say it's gotten beyond that point. Here's the thing. If you're talking about a newspaper poll, you know, you go to the front page of the paper and it says, hey, vote in our poll, You're right. You can vote 20 times in that if you want. But the reputable internet-based polls draw a sample of people who have volunteered to answer questions, usually for being included in prize pools or donations to charity or other incentives to keep them involved.
So they've been screened?
They've been screened. They sign up. They've been recruited through advertisements and emails and a variety of other things. So they're not a representative sample of the population to begin with. That's the real worry that old guy pollsters like me have about mm-hmm. it. You don't start with a random sample. Mm-hmm. But you collect 2 to 4 million people who've signed up to do the polls, and they fill out an initial questionnaire about their background, their age, their education, where they live, and so on. And then when you want to do a sample, you draw a sample from that huge pool of people whose demographics and maybe some of their attitudes, like their religion perhaps, or other kinds of questions, so that they match what we know from census data really are the characteristics of the population. That's the mechanism that they're using to make it work, and they do only select those people. You can only do the poll once, so those issues are not there. What we don't know scientifically is if you don't start with a random sample, how well does this matching technology of matching them by age, education, and income really work? The record's getting better, and we're getting enough that I think we're at a point of being able to seriously evaluate how well this works. And it may well be the future of polling. But it lacks that fundamental point of random sampling, which is what, since the 1930s and 40s, has been key.
There's no tactful way to ask this question. Are people lying more on your polls? Because you call me, and of course, I want to project to you that I'm a very informed, conscientious voter, and of course, I'm going to vote in the primary and the general election. Are people lying more?
It's a little hard to say about more. Since the 1950s, at least, when some of these studies were first done, and certainly since the 60s, where they were systematically done, we know people exaggerate how likely they are to vote. We know that because in our sample, whether ours in Wisconsin or elsewhere, the reported turnout rate will typically be anywhere from 10 to 15% higher than what the actual election statistics say it is.
Okay.
But it turns out it's not entirely easy to straighten that out or to figure that out. Pollsters have tried a wide range of questions to make it easier to say, no, I don't vote. Lots of people aren't able to get to the polls on election day because something came up that kept them from voting. How about you? Did something happen to come up that kept you from going to the polls?
I see.
Turns out it doesn't help at all. Okay. People still are more likely to report voting. One of the complications, though, is the people you're talking to are the people that were willing to do the interview. What we know from studies of this is the people that are willing to do interviews are more engaged in civic life. They're more likely to be churchgoers or participate in civic organizations. They're more likely to vote in fact, not just in report. And so, in fact, every survey should tell you voter turnout's a bit higher than it really is because the folks that aren't talking to you are more likely non-voters. The good news from my point of view is if we're trying to predict the election outcome, talking to voters is just fine, but it's a perfect example where a socially desirable answer plus the mechanism of who agrees to participate and who doesn't always produces a bit of an advantage. Good news is we don't see a systematic bias in our vote question, in our vote choice question.
Okay.
So in our polling, even though that turnout is higher than it seems to be, our estimates of the vote have been within a couple of points of the margin in major elections.
The major poll that was used to kind of set the table for the debate last night said Trump 24, Bush 17, Walker 15. Was that of likely voters, just Republican voters? Who was surveyed there? Maybe I should have read the story a little bit deeper.
Well, and you would have found some variation. All of them were based on Republican voters.
Likely? Registered?
Well, I started with Republicans. That's the common part.
Okay.
But it varied over the last five polls between those that used registered voters and some that used likely voters. And I don't think any that were just adults were used, but it's not inconceivable that they were.
Okay.
And so there is some variation in how likely the voter population is. And some Republicans, have, and others for that matter, have complained that this means you're looking at national samples of people who call themselves Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But that is far from being the same as the group of Republican voters that are actually going to show up on a very cold winter's night in Iowa and New Hampshire.
That's right. Okay, two more questions. We're almost out of time. How do Wisconsin residents respond differently than those surveyed in other states? Are there any big differences?
Yeah, they're not huge differences. There are some. We just completed a survey of southeastern Wisconsin, the Chicago area, and northwestern Indiana.
For your megacity
poll.
For our
Chicago megacity poll. And we had a noticeably higher response rate in Wisconsin than we did in the other two areas. Now, there are differences in urban, how densely the urban areas are populated.
Right.
But it's also, I think, much more likely that someone picking up the phone in Wisconsin would know about and respond to a Marquette poll rather than someone in, say, Indiana, who's not as likely to have heard about it. So there are some differences, but honestly, they're relatively small when we compare them with the country as a whole.
Do our poorer communities and residents in those neighborhoods, are they underpolled, my friend?
Initially, they are. The most critical things that determine whether or not someone responds are their age and education.
Okay.
Older people more likely, more educated people more likely. There is some racial difference, though it's not as substantial as these others. So what we and all other pollsters do is after we have the sample collected, we compare the demographics with known census demographics, and we reweight the data to match some known census demographics.
Okay.
So
okay.
Typically, 18 to 29-year-olds in our samples are about 16% of registered voters. They're typically about 8% of our sample.
Okay.
And so we have to weight them up to 16%.
And then my final question is this. Reading about the Marquette University Law School poll, which you direct, quote, it accurately captured voter attitudes before every major election in 2012, including the gubernatorial recall, U.S. Senate, and presidential races. Then you must wake up in the middle. You're a hero when you're right. You must wake up in the middle of the night fearing being wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. At some point each election cycle, there's that sleepless night, and then you go into a sort of zen-like trance because, honest to goodness, it's out of my control. And I think this is important, that I design how we're going to sample the state. I design the questions and the order we're going to do them in. I design the statistical work that we do. But then it is out of my control. Everything after that, and those things are all set before the election year even begins. Mm-hmm. After that, everything simply depends on who talks to us and what they're willing to say to us. And so it's a misnomer for me or for any other pollster to think that we have control over the result. So if somebody says, oh, your poll was way off, it had this crazy result, I might agree with them that it's a puzzling result. But I didn't in some sense have anything to do with it. It's what people told us. And the question for me and for every other pollster is, well, would you rather me change those results and just say what I think they should have said? Surely not. So the price we pay for being honest pollsters, if you will,
yes,
is that we design the surveys in the best way we know how, and that's where we have some control. But after that, it's up to the voters who take our calls and who answer our questions.
You must be looking forward to 2016 with the presidential election, U.S. Senate election. Walker is the favorite son. When's your next poll coming out?
Well, we'll be out soon. I can't tell you exactly when, but we'll be out fairly soon. We haven't polled in the state for a statewide poll since April, and neither has anyone else. So we've gone a long while there. We were tied up with this Chicago megacity project where we did poll. But we'll be picking up the pace and running increasingly hard from basically now through November of 2016. And then we'll all go to sleep for a month or two.
Well, more and more attention is being paid to polls, and that's why I'm so glad you came in to talk about all these nuances. So,
thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Thank you.